Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How sustainable is our consumption of fish? As global awareness grows that humankind has left a deep imprint on the health of our oceans, many people are asking whether we need to limit our reliance on marine life as a significant food source and what it will take to replenish stocks that have already been depleted. But as my guest today will help us understand, responsible fishery management is a complex and evolving task that requires recognition of the impact of human activity beyond simply the fishing industry itself, balanced with a pragmatic consideration for the role oceans play as a primary source of protein in many parts of the world. Ray Hilborn is professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington. His new book is called Overfishing: What Everyone Needs to Know. Ray, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much.
I'll confess that when I first picked this up, I expected the book to be mostly about decline, mostly about poor management. The reality is that this situation is very complex to get a handle on.
That's right. You can tell horror stories as long as your arm, and you can tell success stories as long as your arm. So there is no simple answer.
And there are even different ways to define the term overfishing, which will be important for this discussion. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. The traditional definition of overfishing is when you reduce a fish stock enough that its long-term sustainable yield is reduced. So it usually means in the U.S. that the abundance is low enough that the stock isn't producing as much sustainable harvest as it could. So it's not going extinct. It doesn't even necessarily mean declining. It simply means at a lower abundance than would produce the maximum long-term yield. Mm-hmm. Now, that's sort of a biological overfishing, and there's also economic overfishing, which is much more prevalent than biological overfishing. And that just means essentially too many fishing boats than you really need to catch the number of fish. And then within biological overfishing, we tend to distinguish between overfishing where you're catching the fish too small, it's often called growth overfishing, and overfishing where you reduce the number of spawning fish enough that the number of new babies that make it to fishable size, which we call recruitment, is reduced. So we distinguish between growth overfishing, catching them too small, and recruitment overfishing, where you are not getting as many new fish produced in the population as you could.
So how are fishing yields regulated by the U.S. government as compared with other jurisdictions around the world?
Well, the U.S. has probably the strictest regulatory system in the world. The federally managed fisheries, which are most of the country's catch, are regulated under the congressional law called the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Management and Conservation Act, and it sets up regional fishery management councils. I think there's seven of them, and maybe it's nine, but there's one in the Gulf, there's one in the West Coast, there's one in Alaska, there's one in Hawaii. And these councils, under rather strict legal guidelines, set the allowable catches of each of the species.
Mm-hmm. And are fish counted when they're taken in large quantities in any particular haul? I mean, is that by weight? Is it by number? Do fisheries self-report?
That depends a lot from fishery to fishery. In the bigger fishery, well, first, we almost always count fish in commercial fisheries by weight rather than number, but then you also sample the average weight, so you get an estimate of what the numbers are, but normally they just weigh how many tons of fish came on. The actual way the total catch is measured is quite diverse. Sometimes it's measured at the time of capture, particularly and sometimes it's measured when the fish are landed. It all depends on the fishery, and to a great extent, it is for commercial species. It's because they're sold. There's a paper trail of how many fish are landed and sold.
Mm-hmm. So when a fish stock has been depleted, it is not necessarily as easy as saying, "Okay, we'll stay away from this area for 2 years and come back then."
It depends on the nature of the fish stock. If it's a what we call a single species fishery, that is, you go out and you catch one species and one species only at a time. For instance, with say sardines in California or menhaden in the Gulf, you can do that. You can really just turn the fishery off.
Mm-hmm.
But a very high proportion of our stocks are caught in mixed fisheries, whether they're sport fisheries or commercial fisheries. You go out and you set your net or you put out a line and you will catch a range of things. And then the problem is that if you have one stock that's depleted, you can't not fish it but catch everything else. And so we end up in rather complicated trade-offs about, well, are we, how quickly do we want to rebuild the depleted stock, and how much of these healthy stocks are we willing to give up in order to let those depleted stocks rebuild more rapidly?
And let's go back to this question of age and size mattering from an evolutionary standpoint. There are good reasons for trying to leave behind the largest adults who might produce the healthiest young. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, it's a hypothesis that old females are particularly important in producing young that typically because they have larger yolk sacs, that is, when they're born, the eggs have more yolk and they can survive food deprivation a little bit longer. It's somewhat controversial as to how important it is. You know, some people say, oh, it's just essential, but certainly we don't typically find ways to protect the oldest fish. They're usually the most vulnerable to fishing gear. And so most fisheries don't have a way to protect the oldest fish.
Okay, so you talked, Ray, about mixed fisheries. There's also this procedure called trawling where you sort of take a net and take it along the bottom of an area. And I think in people's minds, this is the worst possible thing you can do. But you say it's not necessarily always detrimental.
Yeah, again, it just depends on what kind of habitat you're in. So in some habitats, trawl nets really just scour all of the stuff that's on the bottom, particularly hard, rocky bottom. Now, in other habitats that are, have say, subject to frequent disturbance by hurricanes and things like that, the difference between a place that's been trawled and untrawled may be essentially unmeasurable. There's a famous study in the Great Barrier Reef in Australia where the trawling takes place not on the reefs themselves, but on the sandy bottom between the reefs. And it's almost impossible to tell the difference between trawled and untrawled sites there.
Hmm.
So it's all, again, there's no easy answer. Some places trawling probably has almost no noticeable impact on the bottom. Other places it's just dramatic and totally transforms the ecosystem.
Let's talk about the ecosystem effect of taking out one specific species of fish. There are some that would have a devastating or major impact on the overall ecosystem, and there are other species that wouldn't necessarily affect the other ones around them.
Well, that's, again, a current hot topic. That's what we call forage fish. These are the species at the bottom of the food chain that typically eat zooplankton and often provide the bulk of the food for the rest of the ecosystem. And there's been several recent analyses suggesting we ought to be much more cautious in fishing these. So in the Gulf, menhaden's the obvious example, in order to allow more energy to be available for other fish and ultimately birds and mammals. I mean, it's not as if you fish those stocks in a sustainable way, it's not as if you destroy the ecosystem, but there is definitely less food for other food chains, and we just have to decide where our priorities lie. Do we want to have, you know, do we want to protect the food supply for marine mammals and marine birds as much as possible? Do we want to maximize human food consumption?
Is the definition of sustainable fishing essentially the opposite of the definitions that you've given me of overfishing?
Well, no, that's a very interesting point. Stocks can be, and many have been, sustainably overfished. That overfish simply means you're at a lower abundance than would produce long-term maximum yield. But you can be overfished for decades and decades and decades. It just means you're at a lower abundance than you could be, and if you were at that higher abundance, you would produce more long-term yield. So overfishing isn't necessarily non-sustainable. It's just from a biological yield perspective, you're giving up biological yield, and similarly, generally, you're giving up a lot of economic yield. Usually, you're better off having quite a few more fish in the ocean to make it easier to catch them and cost less and burn less fuel.
Is it possible to make a generalization, Ray, about fishery managers, at least in this country, and their commitment to sustainability?
Oh, yeah. The U.S. Federal system, which is the one that's best studied, and is really excellent in that it's got very strict legal guidelines. I mean, overfishing is illegal in the United States, and if someone if it's happening, you'll often find lawsuits sort of pop up immediately saying, mm-hmm. why are you doing this? Make no mistake that the last, in the mid 1990s, a very high proportion of American fish stocks were being overfished, and fishery managers, scientists, fishermen, and NGOs have worked very, very hard in the last 15, 20 years to change that record. We have very few fish stocks that are being fished too hard now, and almost all of our overfished stocks are rebuilding.
Are fisheries still making decent profits?
It all depends on the fishery.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a... And this is one of the real dilemmas in modern fisheries management, that particularly after we declared the 200-mile limit in the 1970s, we got rid of the foreign fishing boats, and the U.S. fishing fleets expanded dramatically. And in general, they expanded way too much.
Mm-hmm.
So that a lot of fisheries have two or three or four times more boats than you really need. And what that means is you're just burning a lot more fuel, you're paying more insurance than you really need. Now, many fisheries have been subject to what is often called rationalization. Usually it means reducing the fleet size. Very painful, because you're basically, some people are leaving the fishery, jobs are being lost, but those fisheries tend to be economically much more profitable than ones that have way too many boats.
Of course, in this country, we have access to fish from everywhere on the planet. And when I first started paying attention to this a few years ago, I became aware that a lot of what ends up on supermarket shelves here comes from Asia.
Well, most of that is farmed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the U.S., basically U.S. fish consumption consists of six species. I think about 75-78% of what is consumed in the U.S. is only six species. And a lot of that is catfish and tilapia from Asia, but that's all farmed. I think the only significant Asian capture fisheries in the U.S. diet are shrimp. And again, mm-hmm. most of that is farmed, but there are some wild-caught shrimp from Asia that comes to the U.S.
Are there any concerns about the sustainability of farmed fish?
Certainly, the answer is yes. But I actually think they're generally overblown. Farm fish can really be divided into three groups. There's those that feed themselves, and so that would be things like mostly shellfish, mussels, clams, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's much concern about the sustainability of that at all. In fact, they're probably some of the most environmentally benign forms of food production known to man. Then at the other end, you have things like farm salmon and shrimp that have a fairly large portion of their diet of other fish. Okay, now, so many people would say, well, that's not sustainable. You can't feed fish. Well, yes, you can. you can do it, and that's where, say, a lot of menhaden and Peruvian anchoveta goes into feed for salmon and shrimp. Now, 30 years ago, it went into feeding chicken and pigs. And there's limits to how much more we can't produce any more of that fish food. But I don't have any doubt that the salmon farming business is sustainable. It'll be around in 100 years.
Let me jump in here. My guest is Ray Hilborn. He's professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington and author of the new book, Overfishing: What Everyone Needs to Know. You can join the conversation by calling us now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Ray Hilborn, who's professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington and author of the new book, Overfishing, What Everyone Needs to Know. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Ray, before the break, you were telling us that there are essentially three kinds of farmed fish. There are things like mussels and clams. There are salmon and shrimp. And the third category?
Things like tilapia, things that are typically fed in aquaculture but fed plant food as opposed to being fed protein from other fisheries.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, and you know, is it sustainable? Yes, of course. But it means you're taking plant food and you're feeding it to animals, and it's really just perfectly analogous to livestock. We're taking crops we grow and we're feeding them to the fish.
And we should say that overall, and again, this is a complicated issue. You think that fish are more sustainable and better for the planet. Fishing is better for the planet than say ranching of land-based animals for food.
It all depends on what metric you use.
Yeah.
But that if you look at things like energy consumption and greenhouse gases, there's no question that almost all fisheries are better than beef production. If you look at a range of things like water use, water pollution, antibiotics, capture fisheries really look good on those measures. Biodiversity is a more complicated issue, but what you have to remember is that agriculture depends upon destroying native ecosystems and replacing them with exotic species, a.k.a. agricultural plants and livestock. Whereas well-managed fisheries maintain natural ecosystems that are changed, but they're still much more natural. So I would argue that, in general, you have less biodiversity impact of catching fish in the ocean than you do of growing crops.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Matt in Burleson. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I was curious about how your guests feel about aquaculture fish, farming aquaculture fish, instead of using corn for their protein, using insect protein. Like, I feed my fish black soldier fly larvae and red worms that I use for composting.
It sounds like a great idea, and I know that. I mean, I don't do a lot of work myself in aquaculture, but I know that, you know, one of the big areas of research in aquaculture is finding non-traditional feeds. Whether it's insects, that's a new one on me, but agricultural waste that would be burned otherwise, there's no doubt that aquaculture is the fastest growing form of food production. I think it's been growing at about 6% a year, and that's going to happen in the U.S. It's pretty heavily regulated and largely discouraged. It's very hard to get new permits, certainly in my part of the U.S., but the rest of the world is just going gangbusters, and I have no doubt they're going to keep expanding, and I'm not sure ultimately what's going to limit it.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of information that biologists collect in order to determine the relative health of a population, the relative size of a fish stock in a particular area?
Oh yeah, that's the two key things are, is one, just knowing what the catch is. So you mm-hmm. have to know how many fish are being removed, and then having some index of the actual number or biomass of fish in the ocean. So for major commercial fisheries, the dominant way that's done is with scientific research surveys, which in most of the world involves going out and dragging nets around the ocean in a scientifically designed fashion and seeing what catch you get.
Mm-hmm.
There are other ways for getting an index of abundance. If you you can do what are called mark recapture experiments. For some fish, you can actually use acoustic sonar to go out and count the fish or get an index. Again, very rarely can we actually count the number, but we get we get a number that is proportional to how many there are. In lower information fisheries, we often rely on information from the fishing fleet, like how many catch fish they get per hour caught, things like that. But those are the two key things. You got to know, is the population going up or down? You got to know how much are you taking out. And then it's also important, in most places we measure the size and age of the fish. So you want to know if we have any old fish left. We want to know if there's a big, strong, what we call a year class, that a whole bunch of fish born in the same year did very well and are working their way through the fishery. And all of that information goes into the scientific estimate of how many fish can be caught sustainably.
So how do you account for the natural, the booming year classes of fish and the natural waxing and waning of fish populations over time?
Well, that's, I think, one of the most interesting subjects. And certainly in terms of just year-to-year variability, you just have to get used to it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That fish stocks come and go, and they have good years and they have bad years. But what's more intriguing and more problematic is it appears now that on the order of 70% of fish stocks undergo sort of decade-long periods of good times and bad times, totally unrelated to fishing. They just, you know, they have good environmental conditions, they have bad environmental conditions, and when you go from good to bad, those stocks are going to go down no matter what you do, and you have to reduce fishing pressure when you're in bad times, and you can increase fishing pressure when you're in good times. But it's obviously, from the data we've got in hand, a very common occurrence, and it's always hard to tell, you know, did you just see one or two bad years, or have you switched from a bad time to a good time, or did you just see a couple good years, or are you in a period of high productivity?
And you've already seen, and other biologists have seen, impacts from global warming.
Yes, we certainly seen particularly shifts in the distribution of fish as things have gotten warmer. You see a lot of tropical species coming farther north, changing the predation mix. We've seen more. I wouldn't call it global warming as much as systematic climate variability. So we've had, like, El Nino, La Nina, you know, we get periods of warm and then we get periods of cold.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot more of that than we've seen systematic warming. I mean, for instance, in Alaska this year, we're having one of the worst ice years ever. you know, the people out in the fishing grounds are you're having trouble convincing them the world's getting warmer this year because it's, you know, so we're trying to, the global warming trend is clearly there, but it's still in the ocean. It's to a great extent being masked by year-to-year variation.
And I have to imagine the techniques and technology for counting fish populations and evaluating how they're doing continue to improve and evolve over time. So how do you know that a number you get today is significantly different from what somebody took 40 years ago, or whether that's just a factor of you being able to count with better accuracy?
Oh, that's always hard. And in fact, you know, counting fish is a very imprecise business. There's an expression I'm very fond of that an English fishery scientist came up. He says, counting fish is just as easy as counting trees, except they're invisible and they move. So there's a very highly controversial issue right now in New England over Gulf of Maine cod, where 2 years ago they went out and the surveys found lots of them. They said, "Oh, Gulf of Maine cod are in good shape. They're rebuilding." And that last year they went out and they could hardly find any. And now all of a sudden, Gulf of Maine cod are thought to be in terrible shape. It's an imprecise business, but the good thing is that fish are also very robust. We don't have to micromanage fish. You know, as long as we keep fishing pressure low and steady, the fish will come and go, but they will be sustainable, and we'll be able to extract a lot of food from the ocean, and marine ecosystems will look a lot like they did before we started fishing.
How much of a factor are recreational fisher, I don't want to say men, fisher people?
I know very few women who catch fish who don't call themselves fishermen.
Okay.
But it all depends. In the big, high-volume fisheries, their recreational fishing isn't important at all. But in many of our fisheries, particularly a lot of our fisheries that are under the most pressure, over half the catch can be recreational. Mm-hmm. And a recreational fishing business is economically on the same league or bigger, if just in the marine system, than commercial fishing. So it's a very important business, and certainly it's for some stocks, it's the dominant form of catch.
So I want to talk about tuna here, because it seems like the conventional wisdom that filters to us in the general public has changed a lot over the past few years. And once again, this is a complicated issue, but help us understand the difference between, say, tuna that we'd get at a sushi place and tuna that we get in a can, and how those different populations are doing.
Okay, the big picture is that with the exception of bluefin tuna, which are overfished everywhere, the rest of the tuna that we eat are generally at the levels that would produce maximum sustained yield. They're not overfished.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're pretty well fully exploited in general. So the issues with tuna haven't really been about the sustainability of the stocks, again, with the exception of bluefin, but have been more about the environmental impacts of catching the fish. So there was a lot of publicity about the catch of marine mammals in the tuna fishery in the eastern Pacific that led to dolphin-safe tuna labels,
right,
et cetera, and changes in fishing practice. Now, it's a great story, because what they did is, instead of catching the tuna in conjunction with schools of dolphins, they then started putting out artificial rafts called fish aggregating devices and catching the tuna under those, where they weren't associated with dolphins. Well, when you do that, you catch a lot of other fish in addition to the tuna. And so some environmental organization like Greenpeace is saying, oh, we shouldn't catch tuna that way. We shouldn't even catch them with nets. We should catch them with hook and line.
Hmm.
But the big picture is, catching tuna always has some consequences in other species. Longline fishing, you catch some seabirds, you catch some turtles. There are downsides to every form of tuna fishing, as there are to every form of food production.
Let's talk about this. I always like hearing stories about the early United States when lobster was considered such a common base food that there were rules about how many times you could feed it to your servants in an average week. How are populations of things like fish and lobster doing?
Again, there's many lobsters, but the big one everybody talks about is the New England lobster in Maine.
Right.
And it is booming. I think their catches and abundances have been at record levels for a decade or two. It's more of an aquaculture species these days. It's estimated that something like half or more of the food that Maine lobsters get is bait in pots.
Hmm.
So essentially the herring fishery of New England is being turned into bait that's fed to the lobsters, and so that population, I think the evidence is that it's probably more abundant now than it was in colonial times, when you couldn't feed it to the servants. That's another thing that, you know, back in the 90s, we really dramatically overfished the major bottom fish species, haddock and cod and redfish and those things. And we saw a boom, not only in New England, but many places where we did the same thing, in the shellfish, in lobsters and shrimp and prawns and scallops. And those fisheries are doing extremely well in New England now. The most valuable fishery in the country, I think, right now is the New England and Mid-Atlantic scallop fishery, in terms of the value of what they catch.
So you mentioned that the United States has maybe the strictest laws and has done a good job since the early 90s in really bringing back depleted fish stocks. How different is the situation in the developing world, and are there things that we can do from here to assist those countries in getting control over places where they are overfishing?
Well, the problem, there's really three tiers of countries. There's the traditional highly developed countries, Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, that have really well-structured management systems. Europe doesn't do very well because their system's very political, but as opposed to being scientifically driven, but it's getting better. Then you have a whole bunch of countries that, Peru and Chile really stand out. Argentina, they have major fisheries. I would throw Japan in with the U.S. and but then you have and Russia in with Peru, and they have management systems that are modeled on the kind we have, what I would call top-down, legally structured systems, and they're doing they've got problems, but they're getting better at it. Then you have the sort of the countries that just don't seem to have a fisheries management system that we would really recognize. That is, they don't regulate catch and effort very much, and that would include almost all of Asia outside of Japan, all Southeast Asia, India, and in through most of Africa, with the exception probably of Namibia and South Africa, which have sort of Western style, that these countries just don't have a fisheries management system that's like ours. And the places that tend to be working in most of those places is where they have smaller scale, often community-based management. And that's, you know, to me, that's really the hope for countries that don't have a central governance system with legal frameworks. And those places where local fishermen essentially seize control of their fishery, and the secret is almost always excluding other people, particularly industrial fleets, from their local fisheries.
So are they in the most danger of permanently damaging fishing stocks?
Yeah, I mean, from what we can tell, this rest of the world that I'm talking about is still overfishing. Things are going down. In general, the estimates are they're actually not as overfished yet as we are in the West, because we started earlier with big fishing boats. Uh-huh. But the trend there appears to be negative, getting worse, and they just don't have, you know, what's happened for us is we've reduced fishing pressure. There's no sign that they've reduced fishing pressure yet, and it isn't clear how that can be accomplished on a large scale. Although in some cases we in the West have aggravated it by, as we've eliminated fishing fleets, particularly the Europeans, a lot of those boats have then moved to Africa, and that's a very serious problem.
Ray Hilborn is with us. He's professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington and author of the new book, Overfishing, What Everyone Needs to Know. We'll resume the conversation with Ray in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ray Hilborn. He's professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington and author of the book Overfishing, What Everyone Needs to Know. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Got a question here from David, who wants to know, we'll see if you're familiar with the issue, is there a happy medium for the Chagos Archipelago in the Indian Ocean, where a marine protected area was declared and effectively keeps the islanders from returning home?
Oh, and, you know, I just don't know enough about that situation to comment.
Okay. We have another email here, this one from Diana in Plano, who heard on a report on Nightline about farmed shrimp from Thailand decimating the habitat of the Thai fishing cat, and this cat is therefore becoming endangered. She says, I heard that most of this shrimp is sold frozen to Western countries. Is that, again, what you were talking about with the farmed shrimp coming from Asia?
Yeah, and there's certainly there's serious problems with a lot of the shrimp production basically coming by destroying mangrove habitat or that is important to the biology of the naturally living species there. And so Shrimp can be produced in much less damaging ways. I don't have any numbers on what proportion of the shrimp we import comes from sort of destructive fish farms, but it's certainly a serious concern.
So Whole Foods recently made this pledge not to sell fish that was imported from anywhere, this country or abroad, that seemed to be endangered or overfished. And there may be other retailers who are doing the same thing. I mean, can we trust the pledges from commercial sellers of fish that what they're giving us is reasonably harvested?
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I think that they're setting the standards a bit too high. That that we have overfished stocks in the U.S. that are perfectly sustainable and rebuilding, and I don't see any reason we shouldn't be eating them. Mm-hmm. They're going to be caught anyway. If you say, "Oh, I'm not going to eat," yellow-eye rockfish from California because they're overfished, well, you're not going to affect the catch at all, and those fish are going to be caught. They're rebuilding. They're sustainable. They are at low abundance. I think that the sustainable seafood movement, particularly the Marine Stewardship Council, which is sort of the premier label, I mean, they have a chain of custody, documentation to, there's bound to be problems that happen with it. But for instance, sort of the classic example is Patagonian toothfish, or Chilean sea bass is another name for it, that it has been on almost every NGO's list of do not buy, and as we talk about in the book, a very high fraction of it used to be caught illegally, but now this Marine Stewardship Council has certified Patagonian toothfish from at least three places that have met sort of the quite high standards of sustainability, and I think that the consumers can eat that fish if it comes from, Whole Foods or has the MSC label on it with a fair amount of confidence.
Are we doing a good job keeping the oceans clean enough to grow healthy fish and therefore feed ourselves healthy food?
And the big picture is that pollution is an issue of the coastal zone and estuaries. And once you get out to the high seas, in terms of the abundance of fish and affecting fish survival, so far it hasn't been a major problem. I mean, obviously the Gulf of Mexico oil spill would be an exception to that, which happened, in deep water. But, the biggest threats to the long-term productivity of fish stocks in the bulk of the ocean these days is ocean acidification and ocean warming.
When you started your career, did you have hopes that we would be in the state we are today?
Having improved things
over the past two decades,
it is much slower than one would wish. But I think that I was very naive then. I just hadn't realized how complicated a problem it is. And how expensive it is to collect the data, and how many hard decisions need to be made. I started out working in the salmon business in Canada. In the salmon science business in Canada. And, oh, my God, things have gotten so much worse there than they were back 30 years ago in terms of the total number of fish, mostly climate driven, not fishing driven. Mm-hmm. But other places have gotten better.
This may be a question you can answer then. We have an email here from Dawn in Addison who says, "My grocer sells salmon and a few other fish with artificial colors added. What is the dye, and can we get them to stop adding it?" Are you familiar with what is done to fish like salmon?
I don't know the specifics of it. So those would be farm salmon. Mm-hmm. I mean, my answer is buy wild salmon. There's lots of wild salmon produced in Alaska. There is as pure a product as you could hope for, and nothing's done to them except catch them. But I don't know the details of what dyes are used to make the farm salmon look red.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Michelle in Arlington on the phone. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I'd like to ask the professor if he could address the problems of bycatch as well as shark finning and what we might do to reduce those issues.
Let's take shark finning, which is probably one of the worst practices out there. I think that you know shark fin isn't consumed much in the United States. There's been, I think, a couple cities like San Francisco have banned it and banned the selling of shark fin soup, et cetera. And the kind of pressure the NGOs have applied both here and elsewhere, I believe there's a lot of efforts underway to get an international ban on shark finning. I'm not completely current on that, but you know, it's a pretty destructive practice, and it's putting a number of fish stocks in serious threat.
Let me jump in here for people who aren't familiar with the issue. This is the practice of taking sharks for their fins and keeping the fins on board and then throwing the dying shark overboard so that not even that meat is used.
Right. And there's two concerns there. One is just the waste. You've got, you know, you're taking all this, you're just taking a very small portion of the fish. And the other is that it's essential, particularly high seas shark fisheries are largely unregulated, and sharks are among some of the biggest conservation concerns in the ocean. And so even if they were keeping the whole fish for many, many sharks, there would be a lot of concern about just the sustainability of those fisheries.
And Michelle's other question about bycatch?
Well, okay, bycatch is when you catch things that you're not targeting, they are usually discarded and thrown overboard. One kind of bycatch is of particular concern is endangered species or charismatic species, sea turtles, seabirds, marine mammals. Those problems are typically pretty solvable. So we have turtle excluder devices for shrimp trawls. The longliners that catch albatross have really found ways to solve those problems. Again, the U.S. is way ahead. You know, we care more about these things, and we have legal frameworks. We have the Endangered Species Act. We have the Marine Mammal Protection Act that has caused us to solve, to reduce and in some cases pretty well solve those problems. Another kind of bycatch is, say, in a shrimp trawl. You go out and you fish for shrimp, and, you know, often only 10-20% of what you catch is actually shrimp, and the rest is other species that used to be largely thrown away. Now a lot of it comes back and is used for aquaculture food. There's sort of the waste concern. Well, if we're throwing all this fish overboard, isn't that wasteful? But there's also the question of what's happening to the status of those populations that we're catching and then throwing away.
You use that term charismatic species, and it makes sense that we think sea turtles are cute and we care about marine mammals. I mean, are we making a mistake in paying attention, in prioritizing the lives of certain species over others?
Well, you know, that's really a question of social choice. I mean, you know, we have a Marine Mammal Protection Act. We don't have a Marine Insect Protection Act or a Marine Sea Urchin Protection Act.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously the legislative process has said we're more concerned about some species than others, and I think that's just human nature. The seas are not really threatened with some of these more apocalyptic, you know, the turning the whole ocean into jellyfish. In fact, that particular theory has pretty well been shot down. But, you know, some species are affected more than others, and we clearly care more about some more than others, and we apply a lot of energy and cost and to protect those species that we seem to care most about.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to David in Dallas. Hey, David.
Hey there. Got a question on the invasive species on aquatics, like the tiger shrimp moving into the Gulf of Mexico, zebra mollusks, and then in the Great Lakes, the Asian carp coming in. Are those genuine concerns, or like coming in or going to disrupt the harvest or future quantities of the fish that they'll be eating their food and taking their space?
In a word, yes. It depends. I mean, sometimes these invasive species don't seem to have much impact, but the ones you mentioned have had potentially gigantic impacts and really transform ecosystems enormously. You know, sea lamprey in the Great Lakes going back 50 years, big changes. And that's, you know, I think invasive species is one of the things we're probably not paying enough attention to. And I know I saw a study in Australia. They have something like 400 new species that they found in Australia. They believe have come through the shipping trade and ballast water and attachment to the bottom of ships. So I would list invasive species right up there as one of my biggest concerns about marine ecosystems.
What are the impediments to creating markets for some of these? I mean, if McDonald's was selling a zebra mussel McNugget, I mean, would we not decimate that population and sort of get it under control?
I think the answer is I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
Something like zebra mussels. I mean, there's like a million per square yard in some places.
Hmm.
They're little tiny things. I can't believe that there's a market for it. But there's probably some species there is, and we should take advantage of that.
What do you want to know about a particular fish before you choose to eat it?
I want to know if it's managed in a way that's sustainable. I'm particularly concerned about the health system. You know, whether the standards of food safety are high. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I basically my rule is eat local. I mean, I try to eat fish that come from places I know, from my case from the Northwest, salmon, halibut, black cod, things like that. I try to avoid things coming from countries that I don't have a lot of confidence in their food safety system.
Yeah. Is it getting easier? I mean, there are web apps now. Is it getting easier to know what good choices might be?
Yeah. And the retailers are getting more knowledgeable, although it's often shocking how much fish gets sold under false labels. But it is getting better. I mean, I think fish is there's two kinds of fish in the world. There's colorless, odorless, tasteless fish that is a medium for flavored batter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so
and,
things that get turned into artificial crab cakes. Is that what
you're
talking
about? Well, I'm talking tilapia. Lot of fish and chips is
is
batter. Okay, but if you're talking about real fish, the fish that you're going to eat and taste, then it's a high end product. It's expensive food, and we should buy it like we do wine. We should know where it came from, exactly who produced it, and you should go to your retailers and insist on it. You know, whenever I order fish at a restaurant, I say, where is this fish from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if they don't know, I generally try to avoid it.
We just have a few seconds left, but you said some fish is sold, I guess, under false pretenses. Are you saying one fish is being passed off as another?
Oh, that happens all the time. Now that we have good genetic tools, people go into a fish market and they'll find 15-20% of the fish being sold as something that they aren't.
Hmm. Ray Hilborn is professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington. His new book is called Overfishing, What Everyone Needs to Know. Ray, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for giving us this hour.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Our senior producer and today phone screener is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.